Welcome, everyone. And I know some of you, but by no means all of you. And my name is Murli. I serve at the Seattle Center. I lead many of the Hatha Yoga programs in there. And as I was saying, I was born in India. Storytelling's a tradition in my family. And storytelling's by no means unique to the Indian tradition. Of course, every major tradition has stories. And some of those stories are very, very enduring. I recently went to London, and I flew via Iceland on my way to London, because Iceland Air has very cheap tickets to go from Seattle to London for whatever reason. And in the Keflavik Airport, they have a little bookstore. And the bestsellers, about maybe 4 or 5 bestsellers of the 10 were Icelandic mythologies. Yeah, and as I was browsing through the books, as a storyteller, I'm always interested. And then I was not surprised, but yet surprised to see how big a part of Icelandic culture their mythology was. And of course, we all know Norse mythology very famously, and then Greek and Roman mythology, Native American mythology, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, and other South and Southeast Asian mythologies, Russian. They all have this. So what's the deal? Why do we have those mythologies? Well, primarily because they have archetypes. They speak to the very essential nature, essential archetypes of humankind and the human condition. Stripped of all the complexities of day-to-day life, it ends up as archetypes. We have in America recent mythology since the 40s, with America's experience with the two world wars spawned our own set of archetypes and mythologies, the most famous one being Superman. And anthropologists 300 years from now will recognize Superman perhaps as American mythology, and then trace it back to the traumatic times of the Great War that spanned for 40 years. So what's the deal with stories? You see, divine truths can be conveyed in two ways. One is through the intellect. That's the scripture. That's the Vedanta. That's the Yoga Sutras. And that speaks primarily to the intellect and logic, and it's called cognition. The second way is speaking to the heart. And that too is an equally valid way of experiencing the divine. So while scriptures speak to the intellect, stories speak to the heart. And in the Indian overall yogic, Vedantic, Sanatana Dharma culture, stories have occupied a central place, simply because there is an art of listening to the story. The first thing is, you know what it is when you listen to a story? The first thing you should do is stop thinking. Suspend disbelief. The more you logic your way through the story, the more you'll entirely miss the essence of it. Okay? Identify yourself with the characters. Go through what they are going through. Chant with them, sing with them, be happy with them, suffer with them. And then without you knowing, if it's a good story, without you knowing, the mind will be uplifted in ways that you can perhaps not explain in a linear fashion. So my invitation to you is, as we start this, sit back, get into the character. This is a meditation of a different sort. It's okay for the spine to be a little bit bent. That's perfectly fine. Try not to fall asleep. I won't be offended if you do. It's fine. But just sit back and listen with your heart. That's where I'm going with this. And the story I'm about to tell you is a little bit heartrending. You'll see. But let's begin as we do. All stories are always begun with an invocation to God and Guru. So let's begin with an invocation.
Thank you.
as we listen to the story of Satya Harishchandra. Harishchandra the Truthful. Those of you that have looked at the schedule, I know it says it's the story of Bhishma, but it's the story of Bhishma is not something that lends itself very well to... It's something that should be told over weeks, not in the course of a single day. So I changed it to the story of Satya Harishchandra. Don't worry, you'll get your money's worth. It's a very... Satya means truth. As it say, bhavatitam trigunarahitam sadgurum tvam namami. That's bhavatitam, beyond feelings, trigunarahitam, devoid of the three qualities of sattva, rajas and tamas, sadgurum. Sat is truth. Sadgurum, true guru. Sadgurum tvam, I namami, I bow. That's the last part of that invocation to Brahma. Sat is used a lot in our yogic path. Satsanga is... It's usually translated as company of like-minded individuals, but sat means truth, sangha means fellowship. It's a fellowship of people that are in search of the truth, not a truth, but the truth. The truth is a synonym for God. Okay, Om Tat Sat is Om, Holy Ghost, the heavenly vibration, creative vibration, Tat, the Christ consciousness, Sat, the truth. Satchidananda, we are 50th anniversary of Ananda, bliss. What kind of Ananda is it? Sat, true or ever-existing, because truth is infinite, ever-existing, timeless. Chit, ever-new, Ananda, joy, ever-existing, ever-new joy. So the word Sat, Satya, truth, is a proxy, a moniker, a synonym for God. And Swamiji writes, in the Yoga Sutras, it says that Satya Pratishthayam, it's chapter 2, verse 30, sutra number 36. Satya Pratishthayam Kriya Palashritatvam, which means Satya Pratishtha, he that is established in truth. Kriya means action, Pala means fruit. The fruits of the action, Ashritatvam means take refuge. He who is established in truth, the fruits of your actions take refuge in him. The way Swami translates it is quite extraordinary. It says, he that's established in truth, the objective reality changes to conform to his word. So Swamiji calls it dynamic truth, not a mere statement of fact. You see, truth has a compelling power of its own. It's called satyagraha. Satyagraha, it's the famous movement that Mahatma Gandhi founded, and it's often translated as civil disobedience. But if you pick apart the Sanskrit, then satya means truth, agraha means compulsion. Those of you Indians here that know Hindi, it's agraha is a word that we use commonly in Hindi and in other Indian languages. It means compelling. So as Master called Mahatma Gandhi, the tiny 100-pound saint, he was the indomitable wall that repelled the mighty British Empire. What was his weapon? It was the compelling power of truth. And that's why Gandhi called this movement as Satyagraha. That's where the name comes from. Now, when he was a teenager, Mahatma Gandhi saw a play, a dramatization of the story of Satya Harishchandra, the one that I'm about to tell you. And he said, I obsessed over it day and night, because he was stunned by the power of truth that this story contained. And that formed the germ of his idea for civil disobedience, which since then has changed the course of the world. So it's a story that's as timeless as it's timely. So it's influenced people across the centuries. Even, you know, one of... India has two primary exports. And I'm not talking software. The two primary exports from India are yoga and Bollywood. Is that true? The very first moving picture in India, you know what that was? That was Satya Harishchandra. 1929, for those of you that know, Durga Kote famously played it in a Marathi movie. Yeah, that's what it was. So this is a... and then then that spawned Bollywood, an irony if there ever was one. It's a really... deep story. Just sit back, like I said, feel the story and kind of get into the bhav of it. All stories begin in the same way. There's no difference. In every story, we always say, a long, long time ago, there was a great king. And this was a long time ago. How long ago? This was an age. It's called Krita Yuga, Treta Yuga, the age of magnetism. When the thinnest of the veils separated God from human beings. You could see God everywhere, in the smile of children and in the sweetness of honey, in the hearts of men and in the ruling of kings. God was just right there, separated by the thinnest of delusions. And in that age, the entire earth was ruled by a king named Harishchandra. I'll tell you a few complicated Indian names. There's only five of them, okay? They're complicated. I don't have any mnemonics for you to remember them. You just have to kind of, I'll keep repeating them until you know. Harishchandra is the first one. He's a great king. He was as virtuous as he was wise. He was as strong as he was handsome. He was merciless, ruthless, and powerful when protecting the weak and the infirm and the old. He was compassionate and caring when dispensing justice. Among scholars and wise men, he was humble, and among children, he was playful. His wife, Shaivya, was as virtuous as Harishchandra was. Excuse me. So if you want to know what the whispered conversation was about, all the cordless mics are in use, so we have to use this mic. We're talking about Harishchandra's wife, Shaivya. She too was as virtuous as he was. And as handsome as he was, she was as beautiful. And they had a child, Rohita the prince. Although he was just a young boy, the mark of greatness was already upon him. And so it was that Harishchandra, the Lord Emperor of the earth, and Shaivya the queen, and Rohita the prince ruled the earth righteously. It was a time, because of the harmony of their rule, there were no famines, diseases, or untimely death. People glorified God through their lives and satisfied their karmas appropriately. One day, Harishchandra is out, outside of his capital city. There's a great dark forest, and he's out. He is chasing a wild boar through the forest. The wild boar had come into the villages and was terrorizing the villagers. So he was out there trying to get rid of the scourge. It's evening time, it's dusk, the shadows are a little longer, the forest seems a little darker and slightly scarier. There's an evening mist which makes everything look ethereal in the soft light of the dusk. And he's galloping away, chasing the boar, when suddenly Harishchandra hears a cry of a woman in distress. "Save me," it says. "Help me. Please don't let them kill me." And Harishchandra abandons his search for the boar and then gallops towards the source of the sound. It seems to be coming from a thicket over on this side. And then he moves into the thicket, gallops a little faster, expertly going through the underbrush and the thick copse of trees. The sound gets stronger and stronger, so he knows that he's in the right direction. And then he emerges out into a clearing. It's a misty, grassy clearing. And the sound is even louder. And what does he see? There's no woman there. But yet the screams are coming. All he sees is a gigantic rock. And sitting on the rock is a yogi. He's sitting in full lotus pose, Padmasana. And he has his thumb and forefinger together in Jnana Mudra, the mudra of wisdom. His spine is erect, his scantily clad, long, flowing beards and matted locks. His eyes are half open, half closed. His fingernails are so long that it's obvious that the yogi is sitting completely unmoving, motionless for a decade. "Help me. Please don't let them kill me." The sound is coming from inside his body. Unthinking, Harishchandra gallops his horse towards the rock, leaps from the horse in an expert bound, and strides up nimbly up on the rock, stands next to the yogi, and is ready to do the unthinkable. He's ready to disturb a rishi, a yogi, in deep meditation. That is never done. A yogi in meditation is as holy as the sunset or the sunrise. You watch it and you be sanctified by it. You never disturb it. But overcome by delusion and unable to tolerate the screams, Harishchandra is about to do that. You see, unbeknownst to him, the yogi is none other than the great rishi Vishwamitra, the friend of the universe. The decade, he was a God-realized being, and it was through him, God used him as a channel to gift to humanity the greatest of all mantras, the Gayatri Mantra. So he's well known. And about a decade ago, it was the divine will that Vishwamitra meditate in this very forest clearing and subdue the evil spirits that had inhabited that part of the forest for ages. So after 10 years of meditation, drawing his concentration inward, increasing his energy by leaps and bounds, using his magnetism, Vishwamitra had drawn the evil spirits back into his spine. The gigantic inner conflict was taking place, and the evil spirits are just about to be subdued. Just about to be subdued. And they were making the noise, "Help me, please don't let them kill me." Harishchandra, not knowing any of this, is ready to do the unthinkable. He stands over Vishwamitra and then shakes him from his meditation. And as soon as he does that, a decade's worth of concentration is broken. His spine is demagnetized, and the evil spirits happily escape into the forest. Their evil presence is felt immediately. Harishchandra feels it. The moment he shook Vishwamitra, he feels that something's changed. There is evil in the air. He knows he committed an unpardonable sin. Vishwamitra opens his eyes. They are blazing with anger. Who dares disturb my meditation? More importantly, who dares stand as an obstacle when I am doing the will of God? Such is his anger that his emaciated frame is radiating power and vitality. His anger, the power of the universe, is ready to be harnessed and ready to burn Harishchandra into ashes right that moment. And Harishchandra is shaking with fear. He's a great virtuous king, but who can stand in front of the power of God himself? Nobody can. Like a leaf stuck in a windstorm, Harishchandra is shaking, and he falls at Vishwamitra's feet, holds the feet and says, "My lord, please forgive me. I was only doing my duty. What am I to do? I am a kshatriya, a warrior, a king, protector of the weak. When I hear the screams of a woman, I have to go protect her. Please forgive me, Lord. I was overcome by delusion." With a visible effort of will that's unfathomable, Vishwamitra calms himself down. His blazing eyes regain their divine calmness. Harishchandra too has recovered. And then Vishwamitra looks at Harishchandra and says, "You have committed an unpardonable sin. Ignorance cannot be an excuse for it. Tell me, Harishchandra, what are you going to do to repent for your sin?" Harishchandra looks at him calmly. "Anything I have, my lord, anything is yours to take." Vishwamitra says, "Take caution in what you're promising. Really, is it anything that I have?" And Harishchandra says, "Yes, my lord. All right, I will remember this. And one of these days, I'll come and claim something from you." And then Vishwamitra goes back to his meditation. Harishchandra goes back to his kingdom. A month passes, and Harishchandra's court is in full session. He's the ruler of the entire earth. So his large ceremonial court hall, on either side are representatives from vassal states from across the earth, and there are scholars, administrators, artisans, painters, singers, thousands of people, and Vishwamitra is sitting there conducting the business of the state. He's deeply engrossed into it. And while he's doing that, in strides the majestic, emaciated, blazing form of Vishwamitra. As Harishchandra is holding court, in a loud voice, Vishwamitra demands, "O king, I have come to accept my gift." For a moment, Harishchandra is stunned because he is deep in the midst of administering the earth. And then he hurriedly gets up, recognizes who it is, and then honors Vishwamitra the way he's supposed to, brings him up on the dais, has a throne of equal height next to him, and says, "What can I give you, my lord?" And Vishwamitra says, "Remember, you promised that you will give me anything that you are able to give." "Yes, my lord. I said so, effulgent one. Happily, I'll give it to you." And Vishwamitra says, hear this. This is my demand, and this shall absolve you of the unpardonable sin that you committed. You shall give me the entire earth with its lands, flowing rivers, trees, forests, ocean deeps, and vast fruitful plains. They shall all belong to me. All the animals, the singing birds, all of your citizens, they are now under my dominion. Very calmly, completely unmoved, Harishchandra says, yes, my lord, it is all yours. Because he is Harishchandra the truthful. He serves the truth and nothing else. Vishwamitra is not done. He says, there is more. He says, I want all of your palaces, your chariots, elephants, horses, armies and arms. Yes, my lord. All of your gold coins, jewelry, wealth, they are all mine. Yes, sir. Great Rishi, they are all yours. He's not done yet. Your wardrobe, all the clothes that you wear, the fine silks and the bracelets, the rings, necklaces of not only you, but of Queen Shaivya and the Prince Rohita, they are all mine. Yes, my lord, but what shall we wear? Only the coarsest of linens to cover your modesty and rough-hewn slippers to walk in the forest. Yes, my lord, it's all yours. He's not done yet. What else is left to give? What else can a man give? He can give all of his past good karma, can he not? It's called as punya in Sanskrit. So Vishwamitra says, you shall give to me all of your past good karma. You'll be bereft of the fruits of every good deed, good thought, every charitable work that you did throughout all of your lifetimes. They shall be mine. Vishwamitra is stunned for a moment. Such a gift has never been demanded, but it shall be given. For after all, is he not Harishchandra the truthful? He says, yes, sir. That too shall be yours. Now, how were gifts given back in those days? You just didn't write a check and say, here you go. That wasn't how it was done. You see, giving of gift was a way of refining your own consciousness. So it had a ritual. The ritual was that you would first honor the person that you're gifting to, because that's the person that's helping you purify your ego. And then you take a bit of holy water in your hands, invoke into it the essence of the gift that you are about to give, imbue it with the power and energy of that gift, and offer that holy water to the person that's taking the gift. It's called Argya. That's the name in Sanskrit. Even today, if you go to Rishikesh, next time you are in India, you go to Rishikesh, Haridwar, Kashi, any of the holy rivers, go there at sunrise and you'll see people giving Argya to the sun and saying Om Swaha. That means I offer myself to you, life-giving sun. They are gifting themselves to sun. That's what it means. Then the third part of the ritual is something called Dakshina. Dakshina means, see, you just don't give a gift. You give a little sub-gift, a little supplementary gift with the main gift. It's as if, say, you're giving a donation. You write a check, and then you give a little piece of flour or a few fruits, and then you offer the check. Have you seen that? That's Dakshina. Every gift has to be given with Dakshina. So Harishchandra says, snaps his fingers, a great golden bowl is brought, and he washes Vishwamitra's feet with the holy water of the Ganges River. And then he takes a water pot, places water on it, holds it to his spiritual eye, imagines all of his possessions over which he held dominion until just now. He imagines his wife's, his child's possessions. He imagines all the good karma that he has done over all the lifetimes. Such was his grace that he could recall his lifetimes at that single moment. He imbues the holy water with all of that, offers it as Argya to Vishwamitra. Vishwamitra receives the water, drinks it, and that's how the transfer was complete. That's the contract. And then whatever little is left, he sprinkles it on his crown chakra. And then it was done. And just like that, Harishchandra, the king emperor, becomes destitute. Shaivya, the empress, the queen, has nothing except the coarsest of linens to wear. And the little boy has to suffer hunger and strife for the rest of his life. But yet, Satyagraha, the compelling power of the truth, is such that devoid of all of his possessions, which were Shaivya and Rohita, they all come. The little boys in the middle and the father and mother are on either side. They stride down from the great throne room. Instead of being diminished by their loss, it somehow seems that their stature is enhanced by their sacrifice. As they stride down, the great palace somehow seems to have shrunk. So big is their aura. With head held high, shoulders squared, the royal family strides down, opens the palace doors, and goes out into the royal boulevard. Word has spread already. Lining on either side of the royal boulevard are all the citizens of the capital city of the earth. They are crying. It's like losing their parents. Some of them are writhing on the floor because so great is their sorrow. They're pulling on the clothes of Harishchandra and saying, "Why are you leaving us? Who are we without you? You've made us orphans." Harishchandra too feels grief. And the citizens cannot hold themselves back when they see Shaivya the queen walk out in coarse linen. And they think the queen and the prince, they always came in palanquins, and behind them was an entourage of elephants and servants, and in front of them were horsemen and warriors. And here she is, walking, our queen, our mother. They too, Harishchandra and his wife, are grief-stricken. But the power of the truth upholds them, and then they walk resolutely. They come to the city gates, and as the gatekeepers are about to open the city, they hear the voice of Vishwamitra. The yogi and the sage, he who speaks with the voice of God, they hear his voice and says, "O king, have you not forgotten something?" Vishwamitra turns back. "What have I forgotten, Lord? I gave you everything I had. You have forgotten the dakshina. Where is the smaller gift that you are supposed to give me?" "Sir, I have nothing. You saw me. I have given you everything other than the clothes on my back. I have nothing. What can I give you?" "I'm happy to give you the clothes I have. I'm happy to give you the coarse, rough-hewn slippers that I'm wearing. I have nothing else to give." Vishwamitra says, "How can you give a great gift like that without a commensurate equivalent dakshina to go with it? I hereby fix the dakshina to be 1,000 gold coins. If you don't give it to me, you will be known forever as Harishchandra the untruthful, Harishchandra that broke his word." Dharmic man that he is, Harishchandra knows that Vishwamitra is right. It is his right to demand the dakshina. That's what the dharma says. He says, "O effulgent one, please give me 1 month. I will somehow find the dakshina and then give it to you." "Okay, go with God. Fare thee well. May you not be disturbed by robbers or bandits on your way." Vishwamitra blesses him and sends him off. Harishchandra goes into the forest. A long, arduous journey. Who knows how many days it took. But eventually, they come out of the forest, and by now they are dusty. They're emaciated. Half the time they've been hungry, and they've only been foraging and eating whatever they could get. Brave though the king was, warrior though he was, what can he do without any weapons? They're emaciated, dust-covered, and they emerge into the celestial city of Kashi, Banaras. It is said that when Brahma the creator created the earth, he also created Kashi. You see, every city in the world exists to celebrate life. Kashi is special. It's created by Shiva the destroyer, and it celebrates death. In a regular city, you have granaries, you have palaces, you have marriage halls, and you have schools. And that's how it should be, because it perpetuates and celebrates life. In Kashi, you have cremation grounds and temples dedicated to Lord Shiva. And that's it. It's the only city. It's called the Eternal City. And it celebrates death. It gives an opportunity for everybody to come there to renounce everything they have and embrace death with open arms, and thereby feel the presence of God behind the vicissitudes, behind the finiteness of life. They feel the infinite presence of God only by boldly embracing the death. In Kashi, corpses, they don't put makeup on corpses and hold them up for viewing. They take the corpse just the way it was when it was died, embrace the death, and burn it in a funeral pyre. It happens even today. It's been happening for thousands and thousands of years. The city is filled with the chant of the great five-syllable mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. And as Vishwamitra emerges from the forest to the rising sun, he hears the chant of Om Namah Shivaya all around him, resonant. Let us too chant with Vishwamitra this great five-syllable chant. Into the celestial city, the city of the dead, Kashi, into the chant of Om Namah Shivaya. As he gazes at the rising sun, he suddenly sees a little ball of light that detaches itself from the orb of the sun. He's seeing it across the Ganges River. The ball of light detaches itself, races towards him in the sky, becoming brighter and brighter, almost overwhelmingly, blindingly bright, and then lands in front of him, and the diffuse form arranges itself, coalesces into Vishwamitra. The sage, the yogi Vishwamitra says, Harishchandra, where is my dakshina? Today is your 30 days. The 30 days are up. And Harishchandra says, O effulgent one, we've been in the forest all these days. Technically, the day is not over until dusk, so please give me until dusk. I will give you your 1,000 gold coins. Vishwamitra looks at him sternly and says, I will be back. Now, Harishchandra is desperate. He goes to the market square, and then he stands on a tall platform. This is where all business is conducted in the city of the dead. And then he says, I am ready to work. I am very capable. I am very qualified in many, many, many skills. Please, somebody give me work. He says, I am a warrior. I know swordsmanship. I am an archer. And they look at him. He has matted locks. He is dust covered. He's wearing coarse linen. And he's stooped. And they laugh at him. What kind of a warrior are you? You cannot even kill a mosquito, they say. And then this goes on for a little bit. Nobody buys him. Harishchandra gets even more desperate. By now it's noon. The harsh noonday sun of central India is beating down on him. He's getting desperate. And he says, I will sell myself. I will serve whomever my master is, whomever buys me. I will serve him for the rest of my life. Will somebody not buy me? Nobody buys him. Nobody comes forward. Harishchandra is now desperate. He's dejected. He's hungry. He's aware that his wife and child are hungry too. What does he do? Harishchandra, the truthful, the virtuous king emperor of the earth, gives up says, I'm done. He comes down the platform, goes to his wife Shaivya, and says, my beloved, I cannot give the dakshina. There is no way I can get 1,000 gold coins. When Vishwamitra comes in the evening, I will admit my defeat. But don't worry, I'll make sure that his curse only falls on me. After all, your only mistake was to be married to a wretch like me. Nothing will happen to you. Now Shaivya, who's normally very gentle, soft-spoken and compassionate, her face hardens. And she looks at him, and in a strong voice, she says, forsake your grief, O king. Forsake your weakness. What are you saying? A man that doesn't stick to his word is worse than the vilest of criminals. He will rot in purgatory for eternity. After having committed acts of charity and piety all your life, why do you want to give it all up and lose your place in the heavens just because of a moment of weakness? She says, I have only one desire, that my husband be celebrated as Harishchandra the truthful, not as Harishchandra the liar. This stuns Harishchandra back, and he sees what his goal in life should be. And then Shaivya is about to say something else, but then she breaks down and starts weeping. She's unable to say it. Now Harishchandra is his momentary delusion is gone, so he holds his wife's face in both of his hands and he says, what is it, my beloved? What do you want to tell me? Whatever it is, you're my better half. You keep me dharmic. Please tell me, whatever that is, I'll listen to you. And she says, my lord, I've been so lucky to be married to you. Every desire of mine has been fulfilled. I've been so blessed. And I've borne you a great virtuous son. I have only one more desire. And that is to see that Harishchandra is celebrated as being committed to truth. Will you please, now her voice cracks as she says this, she says, will you please sell me? I can be a maid for the rest of my life. There are many rich Brahmins in the city of the dead. They'll need my services. I can take care of somebody's household. Harishchandra is grief-stricken. He doesn't know what to do. What can he do? But that is the way of the truth. That is the power of the truth. That's what truth demands of him. So he reluctantly agrees, goes back on the platform, and asks if there are any buyers for his wife and son. And the Brahmin comes. He says, I will pay you 500 gold coins for your wife and 250 for your son. And so it was, the king emperor of the earth, being committed to truth, was forced to sell his wife and his son into eternal servitude, into the house of a Brahmin. But now, remember I said truth has its own compelling power. That compelling power forms a shield around him, that even though he's forced to do these things, and even though Shaivya is forced to commit herself into servitude, the power of the truth keeps them calm, peaceful. They see beyond the trajectory of whatever's happening right now. And so even in this most grief-stricken moment, they are calm. They look at each other one last time, eyes brimming with tears, heart swimming in an ocean of grief. With this one last look, they have the communication of a lifetime, and then they turn away from each other. Shaivya and Rohita walk behind the Brahmin into their new life of servitude. Without even looking, Harishchandra holds the bag of 750 gold coins. Vishwamitra appears, takes it. By now it's 3 p.m. and he says, 3 more hours, you owe me 250 gold coins more. And he vanishes. Now Harishchandra goes back onto the platform. He's filled with a new resolve. He hears the words of his wife, that the man who lies is the vilest of the vile. He's worse than the worst criminal. So he says, I shall never lie. I shall stick to my word. So he goes back on the platform and he says, somebody please buy me. I promise you, I will serve you to the best of my ability for the rest of my natural life. I will even live as long as I can so that you shall not be deprived of my services. This is my promise to you. By now, a great crowd has gathered because they've seen this strange man claiming to be a warrior, claiming to know all kinds of things, yet looking like an emaciated buffoon. And at the same time, they have seen him sell his wife. So they're enjoying his misery, Schadenfreude, it's called. So a large crowd has gathered. Harishchandra asks one more time, it's almost dusk. And then from behind the crowd comes a harsh, frightful, grating voice. And the voice says, "I will buy you." And the crowd cleaves as if moved apart by an invisible force. And from in between the crowd comes a frightful looking giant of a man. He's huge, over 7 feet tall, has a big belly, rotting teeth, foul smelling. He has a garland of bones around his neck, and he has a skull in his hand. He has a blanket draped over his shoulder, infested with bugs and insects. And a crow is flying around him, frenzied, making crow-like noises. The crowd whispers, "Pravira," it says. And Pravira says one more time in his frightening voice, "I will buy you." In the city of the dead, even death is not feared as much as Pravira is. He is the keeper of the crematorium grounds, of all the crematorium grounds, in the celestial city of Kashi. He has the horrible job of collecting a bag of rice and a little money from the weeping relatives of dead people as they come to get themselves cremated. And people adorn dead bodies with a fine piece of clothing as a mark of respect. Just before lighting them on fire, Pravira has the vile job of taking that cloth and keeping it for himself. The crowd wants nothing to do with it. In his ears, Vishwamitra hears a voice. In his left ear, Harishchandra hears the voice of Vishwamitra. Vishwamitra, using his yogic powers, is speaking as his inner voice. Vishwamitra says, "My son, Harishchandra, don't do this. The fact that you are even thinking about doing this is enough of your commitment, of a demonstration of your commitment to truth. I absolve you from the other 250 gold coins that you're about to give me. Spending 1 minute with Pravira will give you such bad karma that you will burn in purgatory for hundreds of years. Don't do this." In his right ear, Vishwamitra hears the voice of his wife. "All that a man has is his word. If he's known as a liar, he's worse than the vilest of criminals." So speaking with the voice of his heart, replying to the voice in his left ear, Harishchandra says, "No, sir. I didn't give you my word. I gave my word to the universe. It's dynamic truth. Truth is not fact. I cannot withdraw it merely because I don't like a job. What does that make me? If it means I rot in hell for eternity, so be it. I will gladly take it before being branded as a liar." So boldly, he strides down the platform and goes to Pravira, holds out his hands for the 250 gold coins, takes that, holds it to the side. Vishwamitra appears and takes his gold coin and silently blesses him, saying, "Your debt is now finished." And Harishchandra leans down in front of Pravira, the crematorium keeper, says, "I shall serve thee, Lord. You are my God from this point on. Your wish is my command." The rotting piece of blanket that Pravira had on his shoulder, which was recently draped over a dead body, he takes that blanket and drapes it over Harishchandra as a symbol of his eternal servitude. Despite all of this, even in this most horrible of choices, Harishchandra is saying, "Though my sea is dark and my stars are gone, I still see the light of truth because of God's mercy. I have made thee pole star of my life, he says. And as he gets up and begins to walk behind Pravira, the Lord Emperor of the earth has only one pole star, which is the truth. And he walks to his new duties as the keeper of a crematorium. As he walks, he continues into the crematorium, and Pravira shows him his hut, and he says, this is where you reside from now on. And your job is to collect money and a bag of rice, and from there, a sixth of it goes to the king, and the rest of it, a third of it goes to me, and you can keep the rest of it. And so begins the new life of Vishwamitra. But he has a pole star, and he keeps singing to himself. Harishchandra sits, not on his throne, not attending to the business of state, but he sits in front of the funeral pyres in the city of dead. It's not something that runs from 9 to 6. It runs 24 hours. Death doesn't come during business hours, does it? It comes at all times. So people are streaming in day and night, and Harishchandra dutifully goes, gets the bag of rice and the little bit of money, turns them away when they are unable to pay it, because such is his job. His duty is now only to his master. That too is the service of truth. You cannot pick and choose the truth that applies to you. Truth is one and eternal, as it says. So he continues this job, but even then, he is undisturbed. There is a calm that settles over him, because he has made the ultimate sacrifice of the truth, and he faces death. He sees change in front of him, day and night. There are young children who died who are not supposed to die. There are people struck down in the prime of their lives, and there are old people that have lived well beyond the prime of their lives. Day after day, he sees the impermanence of life. Because of the atmosphere and because of sitting in front of the funeral pyres, the fire every day, his skin shrivels. His eyes become darker and lose their luster, it seems. But there is an unearthly peace within him. It feels like God is right there. All he needs to do is close his eyes. Beyond the miasma of death, he sees the permanence of the soul. And here it was that Harishchandra found the peace that he was unable to find when being the emperor of earth. He was unable to find with all of his wealth in the city of the dead, attending to the final macabre needs of corpses. Sticking to the truth above all else, satyagraha, he finds Satchidananda here in the cremation ground. And so this goes on. He loses track of time. Destiny is still not done with this great king. One day, it's about 3 a.m. And the crematorium doors, there's a knocking. He goes over and opens it. There's a disheveled, old-looking woman. She's discolored and absent-minded. Her eyes are darting here and there. She's overcome with grief, it's obvious, and she's holding the corpse of a small child in her hands. And she says, "Sir, my child just died because he was bitten by a cobra. The venom was so potent that it killed him in minutes. I need to cremate him right away because that's what the scriptures say for him to have an astral ascension. Will you not light the funeral pyre?" And Harishchandra says, "Do you have the bag of rice? Do you have the money?" "No, sir, I don't." "Then I am sorry, dear blessed lady, I cannot let you." Then as he says that, he looks at the boy. "Why is my heart racing?" he asks himself. And there it is, unmistakable on the boy's forehead, the birthmark of the prince of the realm. It is his son, Rohita. And then he looks at the woman once again, this disheveled, discolored, almost mad with grief woman is none other than his beautiful wife, Shaifia. And in this moment, she too recognizes him. They come into each other's arms, consoling each other. Losing a child, such an unnatural thing to happen under these circumstances, helpless as they both are. And then Shaivya says, "Will you not cremate your own son?" Harishchandra says, "You know the answer to that. I cannot be untruthful. My master has said that I need a bag of rice and some money. Until then, I cannot light the fire. Do you have it?" He makes his heart turn into a stone. And she knows. She knows the power of truth and his commitment to it. She too has made the ultimate sacrifice. So she too has powers, inner powers that she didn't know until that moment. So reaching deep inside, she manifests a wall of fire right in front of her. And she says, "My beloved husband, yes, I understand. You cannot create the funeral pyre without me giving you a bag of rice and money. However, I have created it. Let all three of us enter into the fire and let us be reunited in the astral realm as the family that we once were." Happily, Harishchandra walks with her into the fire. What a great solution. But in the last moment, he stops. He lets go of her hand. He says, "My beloved wife, I cannot do that." Because he remembers his promise he made on the platform. He said, "I will live as long as I possibly can because I will serve you." So he says, "I cannot do that." And the wife looks at him. She knows by now it is God that is moving her celestial husband. Words are being spoken which will be remembered for ages to come. So she looks at him, walks into the fire along with her son. Harishchandra looks calmly on as the tongues of flame become bigger and brighter and hotter and begin to engulf the queen of the earth and the prince of the realm. And then suddenly, in an instant, the fire disappears. There is an unearthly glow in the skies. And descending from the skies in a golden chariot is Indra, the king of gods. 1,000 divine voices sing, "Glory be to Harishchandra, glory be to Shaivya." And the king of gods, he's resplendent in the finest of silks, ethereal they seem, so fine they are, gem-studded crown. An aura of divine light surrounds him, so uplifting is his presence. in this cremation ground, flowers begin to bloom at his very appearance. The smell of charred corpses and burning flesh is replaced by the fragrance of roses and lilies. Indra, the king of gods, comes down, walks up to Harishchandra and says, "O king, your test is over. It was the divine will that the gods test you, your commitment to truth, because as the lower ages are coming, there is need for a pole star for people to follow. They cannot go in and out of truth as they want. And so you were picked by Brahman himself to be tested in this way. And you passed with flying colors." Indra says, Harishchandra looks at him and says, "Lord, for your test, did you have to take the life of my innocent child? What has he done?" And Indra smiles at him so dazzlingly. At Harishchandra, in surprise, this smile is so discordant, given what he said, that Harishchandra looks back at where Rohita's corpse was supposed to be, and there, instead of the corpse, is the boy, all healthy. And he runs up to his father, hugs his legs, and Harishchandra scoops him up, like a man in a desert scooping up water, and drinks in the fragrance of his son, nuzzles his neck, holds him, never to let him go. Shaivya runs up to her husband and her son. They all hold each other. A soft voice of Vishwamitra interrupts this reunion, and he says, "Forgive me, king, for testing you so harshly, but such was the will of Brahma. I had to do it." He takes his water pot, pours the water in it, invokes all of Harishchandra's possessions, and he says, "Hold out your hand, king. I am going to give your dominion back to you." What does Harishchandra say? He says, "No, sir. Effulgent one, I cannot accept it. Do you not remember the promise I made on the platform? I am indebted, I am in servitude to Pravira, the cremation groundskeeper, and my wife and son are in servitude to the Brahmin. Just because there's no clause in there which says, you serve me until you become a king, I have to serve them. I don't want my kingdom." The heavens are stunned. And Pravira walks up to him, except he's no longer this horrifying, scary man. He is the God of Dharma. God of Dharma is the divine accountant. He's the one that's patiently taking note of all of your good and bad deeds. And he says, "I am the God of Dharma, and therefore I have erased your servitude to me. And the Brahmin too is one of the devas. I have erased your wife and son's servitude to them. Accept the kingdom." And this was the final test. And because of this final test, you have now achieved something that no man has achieved before, and perhaps no one else will ever will. You have earned the right. The weight of your karma, good karma, is so great that you have now earned the right to ascend into the heavens in your mortal frame. Come, the golden chariot awaits you. And the gods are singing, "Glory be to Harishchandra, glory be to Shaivya. Such a commitment to truth has never been seen before." Harishchandra says, "No. No, sir, I can't do this." Indra is saying, "No, the test is really over. There's really no more tricks to this. This is what Brahman asked us to do. We're done, really. Come to heaven." Harishchandra's commitment to truth is so great that it's even transcended the morality of astral beings. He says, "I cannot do that. When I was born here, into this earth, into this incarnation, my job, my dharma, my karma, was to take care of my subjects. I was meant to protect the weak and to dispense justice and rule my kingdom justly and compassionately. I cannot, if I ascend to heavens, who will take care of my kingdom?" And he said, "You said, I have this great karma And you said Shaivya and Rohita have this great karma to ascend into the heavens. He looks at the god of dharma, the divine accountant, and he says, do you not have the power to distribute my good karma among all the citizens of earth? Everybody is stunned. Even the gods are unable to comprehend the extraordinary morality that is implied in this. It truly is the gospel for a new age, they say. They feel the presence of Brahman himself lauding Harishchandra's commitment to truth. And so, Indra says, Tathastu, so be it. Your good karma is distributed among the citizens of the earth, and earth will be prosperous and dharmic like never before. And so it was that Vishwamitra Harishchandra goes back to his kingdom, rules his kingdom for many hundreds of years, and then attains liberation. And the king of gods declares that there has never been seen one as truthful as Harishchandra. From now on, for as long as the sun and the moon exist, you shall be known as Satya Harishchandra, Harishchandra the truthful. It is not enough to pick and choose your truth. You have to commit to truth with such single-minded focus that the Lord eventually becomes yours. Declare to the Lord, I am thine, Lord. Lord, I am thine. Be thou mine. I will commit to truth. And so it was that for thousands of years, Harishchandra's story has been recalled in satsangas, in gatherings, just like this. And may we too, like Harishchandra, be blessed by the gift of truth. Let us all conclude the story by this wonderful chant declaring our fealty to truth, our allegiance to God. Lord, I am thine, I am thine, I am thine. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Amen. Thank you, everybody, for coming, for listening. It's so wonderful to spend this afternoon with you. Thank you, Badri, for the musical accompaniment.